Talk given Friday, 7th January, 1977. One of the accusations which is leveled against the strictly religious life is that it deprives one of all the joys of life and the happiness of life. Particularly the monastic disciplines are regarded as killjoys. Now this is a question which hinges considerably around what one considers is happiness, is joy. All the world pursues sensational delight, pursues it. And in the deliberate pursuing of delight, of pleasure, so much of real happiness, joy, is missed, altogether missed. One just hasn't the ability, the capacity, to pay attention to it as it comes quite freely. The world doesn't see that the planned pursuit of pleasure is projected out of imperfect, ignorant minds. The mass of people in the world have certain pleasant experiences from childhood onwards according to their natural drives, their circumstances, what the environment gives them. And because they derive pleasurable sensations from these, and crave for more of them, they set to work planning how we may repeat these pleasures. Now, if they don't succeed in repeating, if they fail to get the same sort of or a greater sensational delight out of the same or a similar experience, then they are miserable, and so forth. Contrast with that, the sort of happiness that inevitably and invariably flows in upon us through the gift of nature itself. We have eyes, we have ears, we have the sense of smell, of taste, of touch, and so forth. And if you consider that the man who sits quietly moves about all his activities and his business quietly doesn't mean that he's passive or static, but who is quiet inside and therefore really alert and awake, well, this tremendous tide of happiness that flows in from the world upon us is immense. Now, the unsought happiness is the real happiness. Not only is it unsought, but if a man is wise, he never stores it up in his memory with the intention to deliberately repeat it. The race of man is quite ignorant of the fact that you cannot deliberately repeat the same thing. It is always different. It is always new. Whatsoever is new comes with full freshness. And insofar as oneself is alert, sensitive, awake, then one experiences the full freshness of the whole event. Now the other mistake, to store that in memory with the intention to deliberately repeat it, spoils both the memory. The memory will remain, it will be there, but it spoils that memory, and it will diminish the person's capacity for experiencing in full this tide of happiness that pours in from outside. Now the same applies to the unhappy things of life, the terrible things of life. And our modern world is sufficiently full of terrible things to need any retailing of what they are. We all know them. Here too, the wise man, the true religia, receives, takes in the full impact, the whole thrill of evil and pain, absorbs it, takes it. He doesn't try to resist it. He remains sensitive. He remains fully alert. Without resistance, in any shape or form, inwardly, psychologically, that is, you see, and in that process, he learns profound lessons. Not only does he learn profound lessons, but if and to the extent he remains completely poised within himself, the forces, the archetypal energies in the world, throughout all existence, in fact, which function in the terms which we name compassion, understanding, and so forth, flow through him. If we resist evil, then we add to evil. You know why? Resistance, fighting against anything, is on the same plane as the evil. Fighting against something is a counteracting procedure. And anything which counteracts is at the same level as that which one is trying to counteract. What is required is healing, the healing of the ill. And healing always comes, always, without exception, true healing, that is, from a transcendent depth. Now, just as the evil has to be healed, the pleasure, the tide of happiness which the world gives us, the pure pleasure, the pure happiness, that too has to be healed. Sounds queer, but this is something very deep and very difficult to understand. What happens when this happiness comes and unsought, and it is stored in our memory? Without our knowing it, we being what we are, not yet the perfected holy ones, we being what we are, this which is stored up in our memory has a binding power upon us. We get inwardly attached. There comes the time when the provocation of circumstance will be powerful enough to knock us over. And this stored up memory of happiness will come up and hurt us. Ah, it was so wonderful in the old days. This, that, and now what's happened? Things have gone wrong and so forth and so forth. You see, the play of the psyche is extraordinarily subtle. So, the stored memory of happiness has also to be healed. Not that you heal the memory, you heal the psyche, which means that the psyche becomes free of the burden of memory. The memory itself may remain. In fact, it will remain in many, many an instance, for the very simple reason that every single experience, every single thought, feeling, etc., makes an impress upon the psyche. You can't get away from it. This is why karma works. It works immediately from this very moment that the thought was thought, that the feeling was felt, the word was spoken, etc. It works from this very moment, the gesture was made, from this very moment, because it makes its impress upon the psyche, which means, do remember, that it makes its impress upon the brain. There's no such thing as psychical functioning minus a brain. You have to have the physical apparatus. If the physical apparatus is not there, then there is no psychical impression. That person just doesn't record it as such, you see. So it makes its impress, and making its impress upon the brain, the electrochemical processes of the body, the activity of the ductus glands, and everything undergoes changes. So the karma works out right from the word go. You cannot escape it. The evil doer cannot escape his evil. The good doer cannot escape his good. Now note carefully, both bind. Both of them bind. Now, this accusation that the religious life and all this is tied up with the religious life kills joy. Not only kills joy, but makes you something like an impervious block, insensitive. That accusation hasn't a leg to stand upon. Because as one proceeds with truly religious living, your sensitivity and your refinement grows and grows. Also, your power to respond, note carefully, to respond rightly, not helplessly react, also grows. This means that the thrill, the vibration, if you like, the intensity of the experiencing grows. Therefore, with the growth of that intensity of feeling, the power to respond also increases. But note carefully, with the religia, the response is not a thought-out, deliberate response, either to the experiencing of pain or to the experiencing of happiness. It is spontaneous, it is natural, it is absolutely in accord with the actual condition and state of your whole being. Now that response is the perfect response in any and every situation insofar as oneself remains inwardly poised. Poise does not mean being a 10-ton block, immovable. Doesn't mean that at all. You thrill to it completely, but it's a vibrant state. It's not a state of commotion. It's a vibrating as the whole cosmos is a vibrating. A vibrating in constant activity. Not the vibrating which is a vibrant stillness. Vibrating in quiescence, which is the original meaning of cosmos, of chaos. Cosmos is formation and activity emerging out of this vibrating in quiescence. It is vibrating in action. That is cosmos. Now you see what nonsense the world talks when it says that the life of the religious is one which kills joy and makes you unsociable. And yes, of course. From the world's point of view. What is the world's point of view where joy is concerned? Making a noise, making a fool of oneself, and all the rest of it. But joy, true happiness, from the point of view, in the context of religion, in the context of transcendence, is something which the thought and the mind, the intellect of the people of the world just cannot reach at all. So this inward poise becomes an essential feature. The thrilling is greater than ever, more intense than ever. Now, if one remains poised, and insofar as one can remain poised, what is happening in terms of the functioning of your senses and your perceptions. You see the fact as the fact and nothing else. You see the truth of the matter as it is taking place, as it is happening. This is a very important point. We all delude ourselves that, oh yes, I see the truth of this matter, I see through this. I do not see through it. When I say I'm seeing through this, I am forgetting that all the time my mental conditioning, my own desires, my own drawbacks, as well as my little abilities, and above all the fact that I function in a sphere of ambivalence only, not at a transcendent depth or height, but at the worldly level of duality or multiplicity, is all spoiling my vision of things. I do not see clearly. I can only see clearly if I am wholly quiet, not static, vibrantly quiet inside, completely poised, completely alert. And I see the fact as the fact. It doesn't affect me in the sense that it upsets my balance or calls forth a reaction. There is a true perception of the real nature of the thing as it happens. No grasping, no interfering with the process. That doesn't mean that even physical action, as and when necessary, is not forthcoming. It is there. But remember, as a true response, a natural, spontaneous, not a premeditated, a thought-out action in accord with fixed criteria or standards or anything at all. You see how difficult the life of the religious is. But it is precisely this which marks our humanity. Translating the word humanity in its real sense, the human being, I can never say it too often, is the happy creator. Creator, not the maker of things which he desires to make. Not just one who has a certain gift artistically or in any other way and he exploits that gift. But a true creator, which means that because his psyche is utterly pure, this extraordinary energy, pure mind, this universal energy, functions freely through that transparent, empty psyche. And therefore, it is the psyche, the person, is completely in tune with the creative pulse of life throughout the universe. We have talked about this creative pulse quite a bit during the last 2 years. And you see, the necessity, therefore, for being so mindful, so aware of all that is going on, within oneself. If one is aware fully, then you as the true saint form the foundation, or let me put it another way, you are the living root out of which will grow the full flower of humanity in you. See how it always comes to this business of being awake, alert, mindful, attentive in the right way. Attentiveness in the right way is to be attentive in the way in which transcendence is attentive. And the best form in which one can put that in words, in our different human languages, is to be attentive in such a manner that you do see the fact as the fact, uninterfered with one's own desires, one's preconceptions, assumptions, prejudices, biases, the twists and so on which beset the intellect and the functioning of the brain. When the brain is quiet, really quiet, just a pure instrument of observation, when it is empty, then it has come to the peak point of its proper development. Both upbringing and education should take this into account. But who knows these things? This is our great problem. So few of us know it. Those of us who have the urge, the passion to do the right thing, to grow in such a manner that we fulfill the purposes of life in producing us human beings. Those of us who have the urge, the sincere urge and the longing, how easily we get caught in this dark dungeon of conditioning. We don't know it. We think that our ideas, that our ideals as we call them, that what visions we have of light and truth and goodness and beauty, this is it, and we'll go ahead according to it. No, no, no. If I try to go ahead according to it, the it is already laid down. It is static. Life, growth, is not a static thing. When you or I was just a fertilized ovum, could we predict what would happen during the coming months? Could we possibly foresee the new world into which we would emerge at birth? Could we possibly function like that? Or see it, or know it? And after we were born, could we possibly imagine or predict what the course of our life would be as the years went by and as we grew. Can't do it. Therefore, don't lay down it according to it. By all means, use words. Nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, Brahman, etc. And do realize all these words have no limited, specific dictionary meanings. They are wonderful, subtle energies to inspire us, that is all. But woe comes unto us when we give that inspiration a particular form and fix it. Then the trouble starts. We bind ourselves. Therefore, we don't see the fact as the fact. Therefore, in misguided religious discipline, we repress this, suppress that. We try to transform it according to our thought process. But thought belongs only to the past, to what is already known, whereas life is the unknown and the unknowable. Life functions in terms of eternity, not of time. Creation is in terms of eternity, the unpredictable. Putting things together, the making of sankharas, sankhata, put together, is a mechanical synthesizing, not a live integrating. I can't do the live integrating by thinking it out, by desiring it, by having conceptions and thoughts and so on. All I can do is to observe completely and fully, thrill completely to good and evil alike, remain poised, learn the lesson and see, and don't hold it in fixed forms of memory or of concepts and beliefs. You see, why religious living is so difficult, and so difficult particularly to apply in the everyday circumstances of life. Because the everyday circumstance of life is a gigantic ill thing. It's a sick thing which stifles each and every one of us. In our free moments, when we go away, we go to some upper mountain top or out on the ocean or whatever it is, and if we are just in that unself-conscious state, then suddenly perfection, the kingdom of heaven, nirvana, is here. And we do experience in those marvelous moments the full impact of transcendence flowing through us freely. That is one of the reasons why it is at all possible for people, for the few or not so few as the case may be, to say a few words about these things. But this is the one and the only important thing. Because, as you and I know, healing comes out of transcendence. And healing is whole-making. Healing is not merely getting rid of a pain, curing a particular disease. It's not merely that. True healing is complete and total healing. It is almost impossible to expound in full, to exhaust the exposition of those marvelous, marvelous words of the Buddha. Come, bhikkhu, live the religious life in order to make a complete end. That's the important thing, a complete end of all ill. Not my ill or your ill or this difficulty or that problem. They are all within this sphere of duality, the sphere of multiplicity. It is a state not of cosmos, but of sheer commotion of disorder all the time. And you can't take the innumerable elements that compose the disorder and one by one try to solve them. If you and I, supposing, granting we had the capacity to take each and every one and solve the problem, you see, and if we lived another 100 million years, we couldn't get through 100 millionth part of all the problems which assail our silly human lives. They're always cropping up. But get at the root of the thing. Transcendence itself. Let transcendence work. By oneself living the pure life, the religious life. Again, purity not laid down according to just a few thoughts and maxims and so on. But remaining alert, watchful. If one gets upset, that is the moment to be alert. Now is the chance. This is the heaven-sent opportunity. This terrible thing has happened. This awful thing has happened. This wretched little nuisance. The little nuisance is always more troublesome. A little mosquito buzzing around you, you see. It's far more awful than a tiger, than a lion growling in the distance. This is what we are like, you see. All those things. Be alert, be watchful, and remain poised. But experience to the full. Let the psyche take into the full everything. So, the ambivalent joy and sorrow, the ambivalent pleasure and pain, no longer binds you. You emerge, you are free of the bondage imposed by one's own ambivalence. You're free of that. And then this transcendent real has become the simple fact where the individual is concerned. See, that is why when one has realized that kind of thing, it becomes possible for a Buddha or a Christ or their disciples, now I'll use the Buddhist terms, then one sees, the Arahant, the perfected Holy One sees, that all conditioned states have come to an end. Jati, the state, a particular state. Whether you like to call it birth or anything, but a state, the word, English word state, is much, much more expressive. Because every state is a finite thing, it's a conditioned thing. It is not the infinite. All conditioned states and the succession of conditioned states through time has come to an end altogether. Or is it destroyed his birth? what follows that term? For life under these conditions, there is no hereafter. That is to say, as and when you have realized that state of the perfected Holy One, time is a fact of physical existence. But you are not bound by time. Being free of all limitation within the psyche is utterly pure, the attentiveness is total. Therefore, there is no discrepancy between psychological time, that is, the way you feel and react to things here, which is out of, and this reaction is always out of step with the flow of chronological time, with its actual events which take place in the moment, you see. That domination by time is completely out. You are in tune. You, the real you, are aware, how to put it, within eternity. It's the illimitable awareness, because it's completely in line with what is happening at this very instant. You're not wishing it were like this, or thinking of, what about that, did I turn the gas off before I came here? You're not distracted. Completely in line with it now. So you function as in eternity through the progression of time which your circumstance inevitably gives you. You see, another way of understanding this phrase which I've used so often, eternity rides on the wings of time. And immortality is the manner in which you are aware when you are aware like this. That is the immortal state. Because there is no succession of conditioned states. We react against, we rebel against, we want to break away from, be free of all conditioned states. We desire this, we long for it, therefore we fight against the circumstances. We want it different, we want it otherwise. But if you don't fight, etc., but are really wise, and you are in tune with the whole thing, you see, then the nature of conditioned existence, of conditioned discriminative consciousness, something begins, proceeds, ends, is out. Your awareness doesn't know beginning, proceeding, and ending. Where will you draw the line? If you are completely and totally aware now, in this very moment, this thrilling in eternity, if you like, there is no birth, there is no death. You alive are immortally experiencing life. Immortality is not the continuance of anything at all which you call you. Nothing at all. No such thing as an immortal spirit or soul or consciousness. No such stuff. All these are finite things, and they are, and so many of them are stupid projections out of the ignorant mind, suffering in sorrow, in tribulation, in darkness. But if one is aware in this manner, one is living immortally. Or, let me put it differently, that is a slightly limited mistaken way of putting it. In life's immortality functions freely and unobstructedly through your organism in time. So you see what immortality means. So as the Buddha said, yes, now I've got the whole thing. All conditions, the succession of conditioned states has come to an end. Done what there had to be done. The religious life, the Brahma faring, the living of the religious life has come to its full fruition. There is no more a possibility of life in these conditions in a hereafter. The whole idea of hereafter and everything disappears. Now, is it possible to see this fact as the fact? To see the fact, not the words which I have put before you, the concepts, the pictures in the mind which have been raised up. Not that, but the living fact. Because if that has happened, we have had a wonderfully profitable evening. Thank you all.